Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale.
Good morning, Glory America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, Inside the Beltway. What a remarkable weekend. What a tense and fraught Saturday night. God bless Israel, and I am very glad the United States helped them. Now I want the United States to stop restraining them. I began 10 minutes ago the program by talking to Dr. Michael Oren, who is right now on Israeli TV. So he joined me 15 minutes ago, and we talked until a couple of minutes ago. Let's begin the show by replaying for you the conversation I just had with Dr. Michael Oren, formerly ambassador from Israel to the United States. Joined now by Dr. Michael Oren, formerly Israel's ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister in a previous Netanyahu government. Good morning, Dr. Oren. I'm glad everyone survived Saturday night. I am curious what you think Israel should do now.
Well, good to be with you as always, Hugh. Israel should do three things. One, Israel should mount an international diplomatic effort to galvanize a front against Iran, to expose the fact that Iran is the source of instability, violence, war in the Middle East. It's now been, the veil has been lifted, and we should take advantage of this moment. It's an extraordinary moment in that way. Secondly, we should change the rules of the game. I can't stress this enough. For the last 15, 20 years, the United States, Israel, we've all been playing by the Iranian rules. What are those rules? Iran gets its proxies to shoot at us, and we shoot back at the proxies. And for Israel, it's a terrible game because the proxies hide behind the civilian population, and we get branded as war criminals. And every single round, Iran gets away scot-free. Not a scratch. That's got to stop. Now, every bullet, every bomb that comes across our border, we exact a price from Iran and only from Iran. Thirdly, Israel has to maintain its deterrent power. You cannot build deterrence power solely on defense. You can't win a football game only with a defensive line. True? You have to have an offense. And every country in the world has to understand that if they're going to fire 350 projectiles at us, and if even one of them had gotten through, it could have killed thousands of people. That's a level of aggression that cannot go unanswered. And I appreciate that the United States, certainly this administration, doesn't want to get dragged into a regional war. And you should know, historically, the United States has really never given Israel a green light for counteroffensive action, almost never. And so it's not unique to this administration, but we can't do that. We can't afford to do that. There has to be deterrence.
Dr. Oren, I agree with that. I agree with that, but I think we're going to be preaching a little bit to my choir this morning. But I want to underscore, if Israel doesn't attack now, if the West holds Israel back from a counterpunch, under what circumstances could you imagine anyone ever doing anything about Iran's nuclear program?
Right now, I can't imagine anybody ever doing anything about Iran.
Exactly.
I can't. So Israel has to act. And by the way, the nuclear program is certainly in the bank of targets here. And the question is, you know, our capabilities, can we do the same thing the United States have? I don't want to get into too much details, but I'll tell you just right off the bat, Israel does not have strategic bombers, the United States does. And that doesn't mean we don't have capabilities. But nothing should be off the table. Nothing.
All right. I've got to ask you for how you understand the perspective of other people. I'm going to ask everyone the same sort of questions today. O'Brien's coming on, Robert O'Brien, Shasner. First question, how is Sinwar in his tunnel viewing all this the last 48, 72 hours?
He's not happy. He's taking the focus off of him. And one of the things I think that Israel should do is at the same time that we're dealing with Iran, we should deal with Rafael and get it over with. Rafa, get it over with. And okay. And people are afraid of losing international sympathy. International sympathy is good for about 3 hours in any case.
And what about Nasrallah? What is Nasrallah thinking about this?
Oh, he's thinking about, am I going to get dragged into this or not? And he might. And if you do, and if we have to deal with everybody, we'll deal with everybody. I was just telling somebody about the last scene of Godfather 1 when Michael Corleone was new in the office. The bad guy has just knocked off his father, knocked off his brother. And what did he do? He went and took care of the heads of all five families.
Yeah, during the baptism.
Again.
Yeah. Okay, what does MBS and MBZ think about this?
they want us to do this, of course. Of course, they want us to do this. And, you know, they may say different things, but, you know, behind the scenes, they face the twin existential threats of Sunni radicalism and Shiite radicalism. And we are the only power standing up to both of them. And we have to do that. And by the way, the degree that we stand up to both of them and we win, we'll get peace. But that's the way you get peace in the Middle East, by being strong.
Now, Dr. Orange, I have followed overnight. I followed the various reports. I don't know what to believe about what the War Cabinet is thinking and doing and debating. Yeah. I do know what Biden is doing, what David Cameron is doing, Macron is doing. The West doesn't want Israel to do anything. And I can't understand this. It really seems to me to be appeasement on display. What is there? Is there possibly a back channel saying we have to say this, but go ahead and do what you need to do?
Be nice if they did that, but I don't think it's going to happen. And it hasn't happened historically, not just with this administration. And again, election year and all that. And we're also dealing, if you can read the article I think I sent you that was in the Free Press today about...
Yes, I did. Appeasement. I put it out there.
And it didn't start yesterday. And so you have a deeply ingrained mentality that seeks still... It still thinks there's hope of some type of rapprochement.
Dr. Orne, I spent yesterday rereading Daniel Gordis's book, Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn, and I was struck by the Ben-Gurion decision to build nuclear capability because Israel was meant to end Jewish vulnerability, whatever that would take. We have never seen Jewish vulnerability on display the way we saw it last night, not since 1973, at least. Do you think the West gets that?
Well, we get that. The West is not going to get that, and we're going to get that. And it's that's important that we understand what we need to do in order to defend ourselves, defend our sovereignty. And yes, the IDF had an extraordinary accomplishment the other night, and really truly historical, along with the United States, along with Jordanians, along with the French and the British. It's all great, but I just reiterate: a defense does not equal deterrence.
And I agree with that.
The Iranians may feel tremendously humiliated. You know, they heard about the pictures of the Texas fire, right?
Yep.
They
pretending that they hit something.
They put a picture of the Texas forest fire. Yeah. And they may feel humiliated. My guess is the Iranians are going to try something again. And if I were in their place, I would do something again because, you know, you can't keep these things secret from the population for very long. And everyone's going to say, you guys failed. You guys are weak. And let's see.
Yeah. Okay. A great.
I have to go on an Israeli.
You betcha. You betcha, Dr. Orne. Thank you so much. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway this morning. Dr. Jonathan Schanzer is the Senior Vice President of Research for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's the author, most recently, of State of Failure, Yasser Arafat, Mohammed Abbas, and the Unmaking of the Palestinian State. He's very good. Guy, he's been on everything, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me this morning. Good morning, Doctor. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Hugh.
I just got done talking to Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador to the United States from Israel. He believes Israel has to respond. What do you think?
I think they do, but I think it's a question of when and how, because I think there is a moment for the Israelis right now to negotiate over certain things with the United States that are long overdue. One of them, for example, is the nuclear program, that deal that the United States struck back in 2015 with the Iranians. They forked over tens of billions of dollars, and the Biden administration has been trying to get back into that deal with the idea of giving more money to the regime. We can already see what happens when you give money of that quantity to the regime. It will blow up in the face not only of Israel, but of the United States. We've seen Iranian proxies attacking U.S. interests and, in fact, killing three servicemen back in late January. So I think there is room to discuss this. There is room to discuss the furthering of the Abraham Accords, bringing the Saudis in. You have to remember that after the other night, the formidable missile defense that shot down, you know, hundreds of different drones and missiles launched by the Iranians, the Arab states are looking on and thinking to themselves, I need to get in on this. I need a piece of the action. It is insurance that every state in the region right now is just really eager to get a piece of. So I think that there are things that the Israelis can negotiate. And then at some point, at the time and place of their choosing, they can respond. And by the way, when they respond, it does not necessarily have to be scorched earth. The Israelis have incredibly powerful cyber capabilities, and they can also operate in the gray zone. In other words, attacking Iran without putting their signature on it, and they can do a lot to weaken the regime. In fact, possibly in coordination with a Biden administration that at least right now is a bit skittish, but in a few weeks or a few months, maybe singing a different tune.
Dr. Shanzer, that is a very generous description of the Biden administration, a bit skittish. They are trying to stop Israel from doing anything. And what message does that send to Iran if the West won't or attempts to impede an Israeli response?
Yeah, and I think that is really the major problem that we're facing here, is that the Iranians, I think, tested a few things the other night. They wanted to see, number one, how Israel's multi-layered missile defense system operated, and I think Israel stood up to that test incredibly well. They wanted to see whether the Central Command, CENTCOM, had coordinated with other actors in the region, and that went incredibly well. But then they also wanted to see what the U.S. response would be. And there, I think we have failed miserably. The response from the U.S. has been, I mean, if you saw the president's readout the other day, he said he wanted to coordinate a full diplomatic response to Iran's firing of some 300 missiles and drones. I have never seen a weaker response to an overwhelming act of aggression along the lines of what we just saw. So I think the Iranians have to be tickled pink right now as they watch the U.S. response. It means, from their perspective, that if they want to do this again, that they think they can. Now, I think that's the question, then, of what Israel will do in order to deter that.
There are leaks and counter-leaks, and it's very hard to tell what the truth is. But I do believe that President Biden has been accurately reported as telling Netanyahu to, quote, take the win, close quote. Dr. Arnn just pointed out, it's not, you can't win if you just play defense. Was that a win to absorb an attack and only have one Bedouin Arab girl critically wounded? That's not a win.
It's not a win. Now, you could say if you broaden the scope of this current round of conflict between Israel and Iran, that maybe the Israelis got the better of it because they took out an IRGC general in Damascus 2.5 weeks ago. But even that scope, I think, is probably not accurate, because you need to take a broader view of what's been going on. And that is, for the last 6 months, the Iranians have been taking shots by way of proxy at Israel. Again, Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis, Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, they've all been taking their turns, taking shots at Israel and actually spending down Israel's missile defense systems. And then if you want to broaden the aperture even further, Hugh, take a look at what's happened over the last 40 years with the Iranians drawing closer and closer to Israel's borders, making life miserable for the Israelis. I mean, they've been fighting Israel, the Iranians have, to the last Palestinian, the last Lebanese, the last Syrian, for the last four decades. It's now time for the Israelis to turn the table. Again, I think the only question is, what can the Israelis get in terms of assurances, in terms of diplomatic advances, maybe even militarily, what can they demand from the United States to put them in a stronger position before they begin to respond kinetically or in the gray zone or in cyberspace?
I'm talking with Dr. Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Doctor, if we don't do anything, if Israel doesn't do anything, are there any circumstances under which you can imagine? Just assume we restrain them, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, restrains Israel from doing anything. What circumstances would have these people actually stop Iran from getting a nuke? I mean, I can't imagine that we would ever strike Iran if we don't allow Israel to respond right now.
I think that's right. And I think the Israelis know that. But again, I think that even if the Israelis are restrained from carrying out a direct response, they can do immense damage. You have to remember, the Israelis are a cyber superpower. You can't say that about them in any other way. They're a strong regional power. They've got an excellent air force. They've obviously shown their abilities on the Gaza battlefield. And this is an army largely made up of reservists. You can't really compare that, though, to the kind of superpower status that they have in cyberspace. and conversations that I've had with Israeli officials, former and current, they say that there are still lots of things that the Israelis can do that will make the Iranians regret the day that they decided to launch those missiles and drones. But I do think you're right, that there probably needs to be a direct strike. A direct message needs to be sent. And I have to say, there is a fairly significant portion of folks in the defense realm in Israel that really are advocating for direct strikes on those nuclear facilities, the ones that Israel already knows about. They've been talking about doing this for the last 10 or 12 years. They've been restrained on a bipartisan basis from doing anything about it. It's time, I think, for the Israelis to turn the table. So, again, I think the question is when, not if, and under what circumstances, and whether it's done in the gray zone. But we know that the Israelis now have actually assembled a pretty formidable menu of options for attacking Iran. It's now a question of, you know, I think the battle between Netanyahu, that test of wills between Netanyahu and Biden, and then the timing and the signature.
Now, Dr. Shander, I call this the clarity window that we're in. Everybody knows what happened on Saturday night, but that window closes. It's like 10-7, the window closed in 3 months, and we forget what happened and we move on. So I would like to ask you what other people are thinking during this period of incredible clarity. What do you think Sinwar is thinking as he watched this weekend? That he can hold on?
Well, yeah. I mean, Sinwar, I think, probably for a moment held out hope that that wave of drones and missiles was going to, you know, potentially lead to some bloodletting on the part of Israel. That didn't happen. And so I think that moment was utterly deflating for Hamas. I think that moment was utterly deflating for Hezbollah and some of those other Shiite militias and for the Houthis. These were, I mean, the Iranians are the leaders of what they call the axis of resistance, and the leader here failed to truly penetrate. I mean, they created a couple of potholes in Israel, and they injured one little girl who was not in the shelter. So in other words, had she just been following protocol, there would have been no injuries. And these potholes have been fixed, very little damage. We actually see that the Iranians, in order to take a public relations victory lap, showed video of a fire in Chile where they were trying to claim that was damage that they did to an Israeli base.
Yeah, Dr. Oren brought that. He thought it was a fire in Texas. I saw what they put out, and I laughed at it at the time. Let me ask you, though, what do you think? There are two most important rulers in our friendly Sunni states, MBS and MBZ. What do you think those two men and their government think of this weekend and what Israel does next?
Well, look, I think, number one, they are absolutely pleased to be part of CENTCOM, to be part of that architecture. I mean, the biggest thing that happened and that no one is talking about right now is that, and I'm in Cyprus right now, and there were British planes that were scrambled out of this country to shoot down some of these cruise missiles. In other words, the full architecture of CENTCOM and the associated allies were activated the other night. And that is a terrific sign for Saudi Arabia, UAE, and other countries that rely upon U.S. architecture. But they are nervous now as the dust has settled, the defense system worked, right? Now they're wondering, what is the offensive plan? And if there is none, they're going to get wobbly again.
Let me wrap up on that point, Doctor. The offensive plan means striking back at Iran. Do you think our Sunni allies and do you think everyone else in the region want Israel to respond in a visible way quickly?
Oh, yes. They want Israel to do serious damage to the Iranians. They want Israel to put Iran in its place and have it begin to fear every time it rears its head, whether by proxy or directly. These actors want to know that Israel and the United States are the sheriffs of the region. If that happens, we're going to see a changing of the region from top to bottom. And it all now rests on the shoulders of Joe Biden.
A very quick last question. Dr. Oren also recommended that Israel go into Rafah immediately. You agree?
I think the Israelis need to get those 1.4 million displaced people out of Rafah. That needs to happen within the next 2 to 3 weeks. if they can do that, and we've now seen streams of people trying to leave, they need to be facilitated now. And by the way, I'm in Cyprus now. They're trying to facilitate that humanitarian aid as quickly as possible to make sure that the photos, that the images, do not scar the minds of these sensitive Europeans here with the idea that the Israelis can get in, finish the job, and then probably move north to Lebanon and maybe Iran itself.
Dr. Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, thank you for joining me in the middle of a busy day in Cyprus. Safe travels home. I'll be right back, America. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway this morning. Ambassador Robert O'Brien was former President Donald Trump's last national security advisor, now leads a global consulting firm, and he joins me this morning. Ambassador O'Brien, welcome back. You are the third in a row. I've had Dr. Michael Oren this morning. I've had on Dr. Jonathan Shanzer. And they have both said Israel must respond to Iran's attack. What do you think?
Absolutely. And the United States has to be there with Israel. We have to have Israel's back. I mean, Iran has taken an unprecedented action. It's like Pearl Harbor. If the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and then said, okay, we're done. Don't hit us back. I mean, this is ridiculous. And unfortunately, they're getting support from the Biden administration. It's apparently telling Israel to, quote, take the win and not respond after having 300 missiles and drones, you know, sent against the state of Israel. It's outrageous.
Well, Dr. Oren said that you cannot win a war playing defense. I don't understand what President Biden and your successor, Jake Sullivan, and Secretary Blinken are doing. What are they doing?
No, look, this is a continuation of the Obama administration policy of appeasement of Iran. I mean, they believe in their hearts, and they've shown this over the years, that if we pay Iran enough money, if we're nice to Iran, that somehow Iran will change its behavior, and it just won't. Iran can't be bribed out of hating America and hating Israel. And what we need to do, Hugh, at this point is help Israel do, number one, is take out the drone factories and the ballistic missile factories. I mean, Iran can't be trusted with those type of weapons. The Biden administration allowed the UN resolution that kept Iran from selling those weapons to other countries to expire. We need to put sanctions back on Iran on the weapons front. We need to destroy their capability, because those drones are killing innocent Ukrainians and killing innocent Israelis. I mean, the Biden administration seems to care much more about Ukraine than it does about Israel, which, you know, that's their prerogative. But whether you care about Ukraine or Israel, you got to stop the Iranian production of these weapons, because they're being used against innocent civilians in both places.
If the West doesn't do anything, Ambassador, if Israel doesn't do anything, are there any? I mean, if they just say, "Okay, we're done," are there any circumstances under which you could imagine Team Biden striking at Iran's nuclear capacity if they attempt breakout? Because I sure can't.
No, and it goes to what's happening in Gaza as well. We've had these Hamas terrorists who are as bad as ISIS or worse, after killing 30 Americans on October 7th and then taking Americans hostage. We're treating them like they're some sort of NGO or legitimate political party. It's time to start treating them like ISIS.
What do you think MBZ and MBS think about? You've dealt with both regimes in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. What do you think they are seeing as this unfolds?
Well, number one, I think it's been shown the enduring value of the Abraham Accords that the Trump administration helped broker. And they opened their airspace, Israeli aircraft. They helped defend Israel. So I think that's a very important development that we've seen. But number two, they're watching to see which is the strong horse. Is it Israel, the U.S., and the West that they should align with? Or are they going to have to make an accord with Iran if they see Iran able to attack Israel with no response? Because Israel is much more powerful militarily than either of the Gulf states, and they've got to make a decision. Do they join with the appeasement wing of the Democrat Party and appease Iran and allow Iran to become Finlandized in the Gulf region, or do they stand with the U.S. and the West and democracy and you know, sovereignty? And they're waiting what they have to do, and a strong response from Israel and the U.S. and Iran would keep them on side. If not, we can expect to see slippage in our alliances in the region.
When I've also asked Dr. Oren and Dr. Shanzer this morning, what do you think Sinwar is thinking in his tunnel in Hamas's last redoubt in Rafah? Do you think he was happy by this, or does he know his days are numbered now?
Well, I think he's probably happy at the response to the U.S. telling Iran to take, or telling Israel to take the win and not attack Iran back. But this goes with the point I was saying, we should start trading Sinwar and Hamas like ISIS. We destroyed the physical caliphate of ISIS when they engaged in the terrorism that we saw Hamas engage in. And we took out the leadership. We took out Baghdadi. We destroyed the physical caliphate. And here we've done nothing of the sort. These people have killed these terrorists and serial killers and psychos. They've killed 30 Americans. They've still had American hostages. And we're treating them like they're some sort of NGO or some sort of friendly political party that we should negotiate with. It's time to get the Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 to start rescuing our hostages and destroy the last of Hamas, whether it's in Gaza or their leadership outside of Gaza, and put an end to Hamas. You know, send a message to Iran through that process as well, that you can't have proxies attacking America and Israel in our interest and getting away with it. Right now, Hamas thinks they've won the war. They've said that publicly.
And they rejected yesterday, lost in all of the news about what Iran did and Israel's response. Yesterday, Hamas rejected the latest ceasefire offer and made a counteroffer, which is absurd as everyone else thinks. Is that all for show for the Biden administration? What is happening with these counteroffers and rejections and demand? Negotiate against yourself again. You got a lot of hostages out. Did you ever get a hostage out by negotiating against yourself?
Look, weakness is provocative, and we've talked about this on the show over the years here, that peace through strength, works and brings about. We talk about the strength part, about rebuilding the Navy, about rebuilding the military, about exercising U.S. force judiciously but with intent. And the result of doing all that, it's not just a strength part of the equation. You get peace as a result. So, we saw after Baghdadi and after restoring deterrence with Iran, with maximum sanctions and taking the actions we needed to defend our embassy in Baghdad, we saw peace in the Middle East. And that's what led to the Abraham Accord. If we want peace in the Middle East, you can't get it by appeasing the worst terrorists that we've ever seen. I mean, terrorists worse than ISIS. When you look at what Hamas did on October 7th, you have to put Hamas in a corner, and the only way we're going to get the hostages back is if they know that their days are numbered. Sinwar and his ilk are happy to send young Palestinians and half of them are retarded or mentally deficient to go blow themselves up with suicide bombs. They don't want to do it themselves. So they're all into self-preservation. Same with the Iranian regime. So we need to put them at risk. And when they're at risk, then that's when they'll let the hostages go, and that's when we'll get some real movement on the peace process.
Last question, Ambassador O'Brien. What does Putin think of all this? I mean, what lessons must he be drawing from Biden saying, take the win, David Cameron saying, don't escalate? I just have to think Putin is studying this and running to the wrong conclusions for our best interests.
Well, Putin's bogged down the war in Ukraine. I mean, he's certainly happy to see this. He's happy to see us with our interest and focus diverted to the Middle East. But the real winner here is Xi Jinping. It's China. And China is stoking this conflict and stoking the anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiment here in the U.S. through TikTok. And so TikTok is a haven for pro-Hamas, pro-Iranian propaganda in America. We're allowing it to take place. And for every bomb, every missile, everything that's diverted to the Middle East, it's a win for Xi Jinping as he prepares to take Taiwan. So he's watched Ukraine. He's watched Putin invade Ukraine with very little consequence, with no real sanctions against Russia. Russia's probably more oil now than it ever has before, making more money with high oil prices. Putin himself is getting richer. He's watching the Iranians attack Israel and Israel being told by its ally and protector of the United States, don't do anything in response. And now he's thinking, this has got to be great for Taiwan. Why shouldn't I take Taiwan? These are the sort of people we're dealing with.
We have to unpack that, Ambassador O'Brien. We have Steelers fans listening, so we have to unpack why China thinks this is great and the TikTok angle. I got it, but I'm not sure the Steelers fans are going to get it.
Well, you're a little tough on the Steelers fans, but coming from a Rams fan, the Chinese are watching what happened in Ukraine, and they saw that America did not sanction the Russian Federation Central Bank. We claimed we put tough sanctions on the Russians after they invaded their neighbor. We didn't put tough sanctions on the Russians. The Russians are selling oil, gas, agricultural goods, commodities at very high prices, and those prices have increased because of the war, so they've benefited from the war they started. So they've seen no real reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine other than supplying Ukraine with the weapons it needs to defend itself. They're now watching Israel, which has been attacked directly, first of all, directly by, and I would take the position that October 7th was a direct invasion and an attack by Iran, because Iran funded as well with and Hamas with the sanctions relief it received from the U.S., and I've seen no response to Iran. Iran's gotten away with attacking Israel, at least so far, unless the Israelis respond. So Xi Jinping is looking at the big picture of Taiwan, thinking, well, there's been no Russia hasn't suffered a serious consequence from invading Ukraine. Iran is being told that they're going to suffer no consequences for invading Israel. Why shouldn't I invade Taiwan and take it right now with Biden still in office? He's got a little less than a year before Biden leaves office. If the American people elect Donald Trump to return to office, he's got a year of this sort of weakness to exploit. And so it's very tempting for him. That's why you see TikTok and other Chinese influence operations going full speed ahead to divide Americans and polarize us and support Iran and Russia.
So TikTok is a Chinese influence operation? That's your point?
TikTok is. No question about it. It's an espionage operation, so we can collect information on 130 million Americans and get all your passwords and data and everything on your phone, financial, healthcare records, your social media, everything. You've got all your passwords, but it's also a propaganda tool that they can use these algorithms to divide Americans and spew out pro-Hamas, pro-Iran, pro-Russian propaganda to divide Americans on those issues. So it's a very pernicious tool that's being used to full effect right now during this Israel-Iran conflict. And China wins big because our focus is diverted to the Middle East while they prepare to take Taiwan.
I hope every senator is listening to that, because the House passed the divestiture from TikTok bill, and the Senate has done nothing. Should the Senate take that up, Mr. Ambassador? We got less than a minute. Should the Senate pass that TikTok bill immediately?
Absolutely, we should fully ban TikTok. But the House bill is kind of the best compromise we can get so far. So we should take that, take half a loaf, and at least return TikTok to American hands. And Chuck Schumer, who has called for regime change, it's interesting. Senator Schumer called for regime change in Israel, told the Israeli people to send Bibi Netanyahu packing rather than calling for regime change in Iran. He's now holding up the TikTok bill from the Senate floor. It needs to go to the Senate floor. It needs a vote. And we need to take the first step to regulating this very pernicious Chinese.
Ambassador Robert O'Brien, former National Security Advisor to President Trump, thank you so much for joining me. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Selena Zito is the third world power structure of Pittsburgh working this morning, because I understand you had a light wind last night and everything stopped working. Are you there, Selena? No.
I'm here.
Oh, good. So, Selena, Pittsburgh's power grid, not so great, huh?
Well, I live in a suburban county outside of Pittsburgh, so it's a... it's a little dicey in the rural areas. So all we right. Got hail, got everything.
Selena, I want to ask you, as sort of representative of the middle of America, and you talked to, what did you think about Saturday night, and what do you think about Joe Biden trying to keep Israel from doing anything in response?
Well, you know, I think that, like a lot of people, they had a family birthday party on Saturday. And, you know, that's in the background. And it's just, as with any kind of conflict, there's so much uncertainty. But in particular, with Iran, because that is such a volatile a country, and you don't know what they're willing to risk to be boastful, right? To be seen as this big, powerful entity. So there was a lot of uncertainty. We've gone a long time without having any kind of conflict in this country. So it was uncertain. And I forget the second part of the question.
Well, what do you think of Joe Biden telling Israel not to do anything in response? It's just so weak.
I don't think we should tell a country what to do, you know, especially one that has been our ally, one that has had our back, and the friendliest country to us in the Middle East. And it's such a raw political move instead of a well-thought-out strategic move. Now, I understand we're in the middle of a presidential election. However, you have to pull back from making political decisions over the right strategic and smart move to make when, you know, for a country's long-term benefit.
Yeah, I think you just touched on the third rail there. They are afraid in the Biden White House. And by the way, I think Rishi Sunak and David Cameron in the United Kingdom, who are going to face an election in November, are also afraid of oil prices going up and thus gasoline going up and consumers being unhappy. And so they just want everything to go back to normal. But you can't go back to normal after you launch 150 missiles at the Jewish state, can you?
No, we can't go back to normal after October 7th, let alone what happened this weekend. You can't put everything back in place. It can't be the way you wanted it to be so that you could win an election. Paul, the world is messy, and we're in the middle of a huge mess and on the precipice of something even bigger. So throwing politics into your decision making is like throwing a match into into gasoline. It's right. Just going to get worse as opposed to help resolve the issue.
Last question. Are you surprised by Senator Fetterman?
No. I had that Wall Street Journal piece a couple of weeks ago where I interviewed him under the Rankin Bridge in West Mifflin. I always forget which side is which on the river. This is always who John Fetterman has been. It is just that 2022 did not give him the ability to fully articulate his positions. For two reasons. He was recovering from a stroke, and he also was, as we found out later, he was deeply depressed, profoundly depressed. And so I don't think he was in control of being of giving his full-throated view on worldviews. I covered this guy since 2005. He has always been this guy, which is why a lot of Democrats in Allegheny County did not like him. If you go back and look at stories, they were always mad at him, but he didn't care.
So does Bob Casey have to step up, or can he slip? I just think it's the most fascinating Senate race in the United States, is David McCormick against Bob Casey. 30 seconds, Selena. What happens there?
I have no idea. I mean, I know it's going to be incredibly close. I think the men at the top of the ticket, meaning Biden and Trump, could have an outsized role in the outcome. Pennsylvanians tend to not be afraid to split their vote, but these two, Biden and Trump, could impact the McCormick race.
Selena Zito, always good to see you on the Inza Report. Follow her at selenazito.com and on X at Zito. Selena, thank you, Selena. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Bethany Mandel joins me. She's running for the Board of Education, but she's also got a guest this morning, and we're great to have a guest. Bethany, congratulations on having a co-host. Let me ask you, just for your reaction to this weekend,
as a Jewish mother of many and running for, I mean, what did you think all weekend long? And what do you think this morning as David Cameron, Marcon, and Joe Biden tell Israel to do nothing?
It was scary. I mean, watching Saturday take place in real time, I kept my phone on having a feeling that this would be going on. Watching it happen and knowing that there were missiles and rockets and drones headed for friends and loved ones in Israel was very terrifying. And it was heartening watching the initial response from so many different partner nations shooting all of these threats down. And the fact that, you know, none made it through is a miracle. And I think that that is being lost. I think a lot of people are saying, well, of course Israel shot them all down. They always shoot them all down. And I think that that's hubris. And it's a miracle that it was all shot down. And it was thanks to the United States, France, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UK. That said, it's been terrifying watching the next response after that, telling Israel, don't retaliate, don't overreact. What is an overreaction to that number of drones and missiles being launched at civilian areas? That's no other nation in the world would be asked to exercise restraint in that circumstance.
You know, I was in response to Saturday Night's attack, I reviewed Daniel Gordis's book yesterday, The Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn. He reminds us that, quote, Israel was meant to end Jewish vulnerability, whatever that would take. It's why Ben-Gurion went and got nukes and sent Shimon Peres to France to get France to work. If Israel doesn't respond, it's not really doing its job, is it, as the Jewish state?
No. No, and it's been really terrifying to watch friends who were born there and also who moved there from different countries saying, this is the first time that I'm questioning if I have a future in this country raising my children here, because they went through COVID. Then they went through 10/7, and 6 months later, they're in their bomb shelters, really not sure if these rockets and missiles are going to make their way through. And they're wondering, you know, what kind of world is this that I'm raising my children in? And it's a really scary question.
You know, that was brought up by, I don't know if it was Dr. Shanzer or Dr. Oren or Ambassador O'Brien. Someone said this morning, Iran wants to make life unlivable in Israel.
Yeah.
And they don't need to hit anything to do that. They're just trying to drive out capital. It hadn't occurred to me yet that they win if Israel does nothing. Because Joe Biden's saying, take the win. It's not a win.
And it's funny because the reporting that I'm seeing coming out is saying Bibi, of everyone in the government, Bibi was the one saying, let's hold back a little bit. Let's hold the horses back for a moment. And everyone who doesn't understand how the Israeli government works and who Bibi is surprised. They're saying, oh, my goodness, I can't believe Bibi's the one that's saying hold back. Well, then you haven't been paying attention.
Well, not many people in America understand. I'm not going to hold myself out as an expert on Israeli politics. But I did hear Dr. Oren say this morning, the most instructive thing to watch is the end of Godfather 1. Because if Israel has to, they'll do that. And I would applaud if they do that, if they just go take out the leadership of these rogue regimes and terrorist organizations. But Joe Biden is saying, don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, if you've watched enough movies, then you think maybe that's what will happen. I, too, have watched many movies, and I hope that they, you know, send secret forces into Qatar and start assassinating folks. That would be awfully nice. But at the end of the day, you know, Israel is facing a war in Gaza. They have to on the night of what was of the rocket attacks separately, there were almost incursions from the West Bank into a city called Beit El, where we have friends. And they were able to take down the fence. A mob of people were able to take down the fence. And the IDF soldiers on the other side were only barely able to hold people back. I have a good friend, Gabe, and I'm actually going to tweet a link to a fundraiser for his unit. He's an American guy who moved there when he was 22. And he's stationed for the next 2 months on a West Bank border town, keeping those families safe, because they're not just in the north, they're not just in Gaza, but they're also keeping people safe from possible violence in the West Bank. And on top of that, then they're also facing these aerial threats from Yemen, from Iran. It's really multi-front war, and this is a volunteer army. I mean, it's terrifying.
It's a five-front war,
And Joe Biden is saying, take the win. I don't understand it. Bethany Mandel, I appreciate your taking the time this morning to relay a point of view from America on this. I want your co-host back, by the way. Your co-host can come back anytime, Bethany. Thank you very much. Have a good weekend. Bethany Mandel at Bethany. What's the website for you, Bethany, for the Board of Education run?
Bethany4BOE.com. And donations help me send mailers, and it's the only way I'm going to pass the primary in a month. So please, please donate so I can mail, last mail to this entire county.
Bethany, the number 4BOE.com. Bethany, the number 4BOE.com.
If tears began to run, I guess I'll start at the beginning.
Welcome back, America. That music means you're either listening to Look Through the Chaos podcast or you're listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show talking to former Congressman John Campbell. Representative Campbell, you're obviously live, so we're not listening to Through the Chaos podcast, but I hope this week you will discuss the impact of Iran's attack on Israel on markets, because thus far there hadn't been any, which I'm sort of surprised by.
Yeah, and I am surprised too, but markets these days are not reacting the way they always have. You would think that because of what happened over the weekend and the potential for Israel to retaliate, and there's a number of ways for them to retaliate if they decide to do that, but amongst them is you could create internal chaos in Iran very easily by taking out their oil refineries, which are pretty easy for
of which they have 10.
With the military.
They have 10 refineries.
Right. And with the military capability of Israel, you could take those out very easily. The country would stop moving. If perhaps they felt we know there's been internal unrest in Iran for years now. And because it's an autocratic oppressive regime, they just put that down. But if you did something like that, might you have encouraged that unrest? Might that unrest to topple the regime increase? Who knows? I don't know the answer to this. The Israelis do, and I'm confident they'll make the right decision, whatever that is. But because of that risk, you would think, and Iran still produces quite a bit of oil, et cetera. You would think oil would be going up this morning. It's not. We're taping this right, and we're not taping this. We're on live. It's going down. The price of oil is going down. And it's down, apparently, as I'm reading this morning, because traders think, oh, Biden told them not to respond. Take the win. They're not going to respond. Everything's going to be fine. This is the end. They shot these missiles. Most of them were intercepted. Now Iran said, okay, all done, all fine. And so that's what markets are thinking this morning, partially because that's what markets want to think. These markets right now are amazingly optimistic. They don't see the glass as half full. They see a glass that has just a little bit of water at the bottom and see it as completely full. It's just amazing how these markets react. Now, gold, you would also think would go up this morning, and markets, stock market, you would think would go down. And you would think that bond yields would go down. Would go down, and the price of bonds would go up. Because normally people say, uh-oh, oil's going to go up. There's unrest. Find safety in gold. Oh, stock markets are bad because people are going to, pull their horns in and not buy as much stuff, and companies won't do as well. So stocks will go down, and people will find safety in bonds as well, where they can just clip a coupon and get interest. But that isn't what's happening this morning. Right now, the stock market is the futures are up. Oil, as we've mentioned, is down. Gold is up, but gold right now is operating in its own kind of universe right now, with people around. Americans are still on balance selling gold, but people around the rest of the world are on balance buying gold, including central banks around the world. So gold is up today, which is just right now, which you would expect.
Yes,
but I'm not sure it has anything to do. Yeah, but I'm not sure it actually has anything to do with the conflict in the Middle East. I have a feeling it's just that gold is right now on a slow march up because the world is worried about currencies and what's happening with the value of their currency, something we'll talk more about on Look Through the Chaos podcast in the coming weeks. But so and the market was down hard on Friday. mainly because of inflation fears. But and so now the market is back up. And again, I think traders are thinking, oh, all done. Everything's fine. Biden said don't respond. They won't respond. And so back to normal. And normal is buy the dip in markets these days, which everyone thinks whenever the market that the markets go, not everyone, but a lot of people, not me, but a lot of people think markets are just going up forever. And so whenever they drop, that's a good time to buy. So every time we have a down market these days, the next day, it almost always goes up. And this is the next day.
I don't give financial advice, but I have been struck by how unpredictable what used to be predictable was. But I do believe strongly that Team Biden is trying to keep oil prices down in advance of the election, because we know what happens if oil goes up. We pay for it immediately, almost immediately, because oil is priced forward, correct?
Correct. And it is the element of inflation that is most obvious to the vast majority of people, because they know what that stuff costs. There might be things at the market, or they only pay for their insurance twice a year or whatever. There's some things that as they go up, they don't see them every day or every week. With the price of gasoline, you do. And people buy it once or twice or three times or four times a week. And they know what it costs. And when it goes up, they see it immediately. It impacts them immediately. And they feel it. And the Biden campaign team is smart enough to know that. Look, everything this administration does, everything is geared towards becoming reelected so they can continue the march of America towards neo-Marxism.
Let me pause on that. Do you find it extraordinary that a president facing reelection does not address the United States on Saturday night or Sunday? I just find that he must be infirm and unable to give even a 3-minute speech.
I don't think that's it. I think he, when you look at when he pulled out of Afghanistan and the way he did it and how apparently he even overruled some of his advisors, et cetera, my belief is that he has all this time wanted to be the peace president, the president who pulled out of conflicts, who put America in no new conflicts, et cetera, et cetera. We all know, or those of us who read history know, that when your objective is peace through weakness, that you wind up with wars. The lessons of history are clear in that regard. So he wanted to be the peace president. He hasn't been the peace president. He's still desperately trying to do that. He would come speak to the nation if Israel doesn't respond for some reason. Then he might come speak to the nation and say, see, here I am. I stopped war.
Peace in our time. Peace in our time. I said this yesterday on Twitter, that on X, I have to call it by that. It's like Neville Chamberlain telling the Czechs after he sold them out, hey, it's just the Sudetenland. Take the win.
Exactly. 100% right. It's so easy for us to make comparisons to Neville Chamberlain that it's almost a slam dunk. But you have to, because they're perfect. The comparisons are nearly perfect. What's going on here? But he would only speak to the nation if he had the ability to say peace in our time. And that's what he wants to do. So I'm not surprised at all that he didn't come out and do that.
You're more generous than I am. I saw him back from the beach on Saturday, and I thought to myself, he is not moving fast. And I just think we're voting for Kamala Harris for president if we vote for Kamala Harris and Biden.
Well, I think there's no question that you are. I think it's a question of when Kamala Harris becomes president. I mean, if Biden were to be reelected, we're talking about their being in office for more than 4.5 more years. And his decline in the last 3.5 years is so dramatic that and declines with age. I mean, I'm no spring chicken. They don't get better. You don't suddenly, start to go the other way. It just doesn't happen that way. So I think you are.
You mean I'm not going to be right. Faster than I am now? I'm not going to get back to my 1993 marathon time?
I don't think so. And like the aches and pains and that stuff, yeah, I don't think they just suddenly go away either. No, I don't think it just doesn't seem to work that way.
You know, I was counting. I did a 312 marathon in 1983. I was kind of counting on that. I can't do that anymore. It might surprise you.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll let you be the judge of that. But if you find that difficult, there might be some reasoning behind that.
So let me ask you, what do you think Israel does now? What do you think Israel has to do now?
I was actually talking to Generalissimo before I came on. I don't know. And the reason I don't know is I don't have the information to know. But the War Council does. And so, you know, there's an old saying in business, begin with the end in mind. When you put in a strategy, think about where it's going to go. Where is it going to head? When you take step one, what happens after that? And then what's your step two? So one thing they, I'm sure, are considering is there any opportunity to create or fester the unrest within Iran? Where are the Saudis on all this? And Jordan, if they supposedly are happy to see Iran not succeed in a lot of this, where are they in this? I hope that they're not considering where Biden is, because where Biden is meaningless. It's as we just said, it's only intended for his reelection. He doesn't care what happens to Israel. He doesn't care what happens to the Middle East. He doesn't care about any of this stuff. As long as it doesn't hurt Hunter or the people who supply Hunter cocaine or interfere with his reelection.
So I want to add David Cameron in the United Kingdom.
Let me just say, if they make a military response, what will Iran do back, and what do they do back, and where does that all lead? And so that's a whole bunch of thinking that needs to be done that I don't have the capability of doing because I don't have the information.
I assume that's why Netanyahu called off the instant response if press reports are right. But I think David Cameron, the foreign minister in the United Kingdom, saying don't do anything. It's the same dynamic. They're facing an election in November. People don't know that in the United States. Anyone facing election does not want oil prices to go up. Last word to you, John Campbell.
No. And David, no, that's right. They don't. And David Cameron, boy, he was prime minister when I was in Congress, and I was very involved with UK issues and so forth, and had conversations with him. And I liked him as prime minister at that time. But man, he is really gone off the wagon, in my opinion, lately.
I agree. I don't know what Rishi Sunak was thinking. Like Neville Chamberlain. We've got to get Neville back. John Campbell, thank you. Look Through the Chaos podcast today. We'll post a little bit later today with Generalissimo and John Campbell. And on Twitter, Look Through Chaos, THRU, Look Through Chaos. I'll be right back with David Bonson. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Markets are not acting the way we expect. John Campbell and I just discussed that. And I have David Bonson now from the Bonson Group out on the West Coast. Good morning, David. How are you?
Well, good morning, Hugh. Doing well.
Well, I just said oil is down, gold is down, futures are up. This is not what I expected after Israel took 350 missiles, even though none of them killed anybody yet. One Bedouin girl is deeply injured. What is going on here, David?
Yeah, I can see why it is a surprise, but I want to explain why it's actually what you would expect. It's unwinding everything that was done on Friday. Going into Friday, the market action was preparing for something to happen over the weekend. So you had bond yields drop because people were flying to safety. Stocks got crushed. Oil was up. Gold was up. Then over the weekend, you had this event that obviously was a horrific attack from a bad actor against a good actor, and the good guys won so far. So the markets are now unwinding what they did on Friday. As you said, there wasn't a large death count, and there is anticipation that this may start to de-escalate, that Iran is saying, okay, we did our piece, and so forth. So markets could be wrong. It may re-escalate. But right now, it's just financial markets unwinding the fears from Friday.
Now, David, assume for a moment that Dr. Oren, who was on earlier, is right, and that Israel must respond and do so in a visible way. What happens after they do that?
It's very difficult to answer how markets respond to geopolitical events because I've studied 100 years of market responses and it never, and I mean never, goes the way you expect. Sometimes there's high volatility, Hugh, for 10 days and then things are completely back to normal. When Hamas launched that absolutely unspeakable attack on October 7th, the stock market was up the next day. The bond market was closed because it was Columbus Day in America. So you kind of got a distorted response. But it's short term and a few months out. It's sometimes a big surprise. I think Israel will respond, but the way markets respond is going to depend on what the response is and where the U.S. is in it. I mean, what type of response they do coordinated between Israel and the U.S. against Iran will totally drive market response.
David Bahnsen, CEO of the Bahnsen Group, I also have to ask you, the Iranians grabbed their fourth big ship and seized it and took it. It's docked. I just saw a picture of it. I posted it on my X account. It's docked with the other three tankers they've taken. The Houthis are continuing to shoot at the Red Sea traffic. What is this doing to the international economy?
Well, so far, there hasn't been a huge impact, and there's been a few different things that have been shaking out over the last couple of weeks. It has moved the markets marginally on a supply chain level. I don't want to say there's been no change, but it's been marginal. But again, marginal supply chain issues have a way of turning into larger ones, and it's very difficult to overreact because there's so many moving parts. But again, oil prices had been steadily in the 75 range for much of last year, and they've really been kind of baked into 85 now, not just for a few days, but for a few weeks. But 85 is a lot different than 100. And if it holds here in the high 80s, that may just be markets saying they're content that production levels are sufficient, even with any supply disruptions that could come about.
Last question, David. The inflation numbers on Friday also spooked a lot of people. I think they're kind of inevitable given the amount of money in the system. But what do you think about that sticky inflation fear?
Well, this is an area, Hugh, where you have to forgive me because I don't have the party line on what's going on here. I don't think this is a political story in terms of the way I'm economically analyzing it. It's purely political in the fact that no matter what, higher prices hurt the incumbent. But you more or less have major categories in deflation right now. Travel cost went way down, used car prices, apparel, clothing, but a 22% spike year over year in auto insurance really skewed the data. And there has been stickiness in a lot of services where core goods have been at about flat level for quite some time. The whole problem with this, Hugh, is that it was never primarily about the politics of it. It was about the supply chain being shut down after COVID. And so I think people draw a meta narrative out of what their desired political view is, where to me, I think all the excess money that's out there ultimately puts downward pressure on growth because the debt has to be paid in the future and that takes away from growth. So when people on the right talk about a too hot economy, an economy running too hot, it drives me crazy. People having jobs does not create inflation.
Was it correct that the 330,000 jobs were part-time jobs by and large?
There were a significant amount of part-time, but not all 330,000 were. 39,000 construction jobs were full-time, 70,000 food, beverage, hospitality were full-time. But there is a 0.1% move higher in part-time relative to the norm. But the weekly unemployment claims tell you all you need to know. We can look at the household survey, the ADP. There's all this skewed and conflicting data. People take unemployment when they don't have jobs, so they're not taking unemployment.
And what's that tell us, David, quickly? I don't know.
Our major job problem is not that people who want a job can't find one. Our major job problem is we don't have enough workers looking for a job. Labor participation, that's our problem.
David Bahnsen, follow him on Twitter, on X at David Bahnsen, B-A-H-N-S-E-N. Follow me to Tomorrow America. And Highly Concentrated Hugh will put all this together for you later in the day over at iTunes, Spotify, and the Salem Podcast Network. Thank you, Harley. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Dwayne.